business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-11-0000611. Hanakimi v. Yoshio. Arguing for the appellant, David Kimo Frankel. Also appearing for the appellant, Ashley Bowman.
Morning.
Arguing for the appellees, Yoshioka and others, John Cruz Manoff. Also appearing for the appellees, Yoshioka and others, Lindsay McAlee.
Morning.
Arguing for the appellees, Iva and others, William Weinhoff. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Counsel for both sides, are you ready to proceed? Okay, and my understanding of how we've allocated time today, Mr. Frankel, you'll start with 23 minutes of opening argument. Mr. Manout, we'll hear from you for 20 minutes on behalf of Mr. Yoshioka and the city defendants. Then Mr. Weinhoff, 10 minutes on behalf of William Isla and the other state defendants, but not on behalf of the Oahu Island Burial Council. Is that correct? And then 7 minutes from Mr. Frankel in rebuttal. Is that everyone's understanding? Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Frankel. Thank you.
Aloha, Chief Justice and members of the court. In 1990, the state legislature found Native Hawaiian unmarked burials, or IWI, are especially vulnerable and often not afforded the protection of law, which assures dignity and freedom from unnecessary disturbance. This case concerns the state and city's failure to follow the procedures enacted to ensure appropriate treatment of burials. Although the burials at issue in this case do not have headstones like those in Punch Bowl that will be honored this weekend, they are no less deserving of respect. In order to fast-track the rail project and nail down the route, the city has delayed completion of the archaeological inventory survey until after approval and construction is commenced, even though it admits there's a high likelihood that the rail project will affect burials. Today, I'd like to discuss five things. First, the importance of the archaeological inventory survey. Second, the plain language, construction, and intent behind HRS Chapter 6E and its rules. Third, HRS Chapter 343. Fourth, HRS Chapter 205A, and finally, the harm involved in this case. In short, HRS Chapter 6E, 343, and 205A require an AIS for the entire rail project before decision-making and before construction. Turning to the importance of the Archaeological Inventory Survey, or AIS. An AIS is the key tool used for identification of, consultation about, and decision-making on burials. Segmenting, piecemealing, or phasing an AIS excludes vital information from decision-makers, renders consultations with Native Hawaiians in good faith a meaningless exercise.
Mr. Frankel, before you get started on the substance, can you explain to me why Ms. Kalaikini has standing and, in fact, has suffered irreparable harm?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to divide my answer into the substantive harm and the procedural harm, if I can. Substantively, this case, the city has admitted that the rail project will have an adverse effect on burials. The city says it's understood the project would have an adverse effect on known and as yet undetected archaeological resources. The U.S. Supreme Court, back in 1829, upheld an injunction to protect burials, observing that the sepulchres of the dead are to be violated. The feelings of religion and the sentiment of natural affection and of the kindred and friends of the deceased are to be wounded. So it's centuries-old case law. Plaintiff is a recognized cultural descendant of the Iwi in Kaka'ako. The unnecessary removal of Iwi causes her great pain and suffering, and this court addressed it in part when she brought another case against Laura Thielen, case that you resolved in 2010, and talked about the standing issue there. In this case, if we look at the procedural harm that's involved, the Super Ferry case recognized procedural harm, but if you look at the decades of case law from this court, there are three themes that emerge. One is the harm caused by the failure to consider impacts before decision making. A second is the failure to look at impacts holistically or cumulatively. And third is the failure to facilitate public participation and ensure the public has information before a decision is made. These themes are found in the following cases. In terms of the failure to consider effects prior to decision making, we see that in your concurrence and the dissent in Sierra Club versus Hawaii Tourism Authority. You see it in the Super Ferry case. You see it in the Citizens case, Citizens for the Protection of North Kohala Coastline, in which it's discussed at length the inflexibility that occurs when an agency expends money and time before getting all the information necessary.
But Mr. Frankel, the city argues that right now construction is taking place out in West Oahu and that there'll be time to make adjustments perhaps to the route, and that would be a question I have for you as to whether you would agree that there is a potential for adjustments to the route, but time to make adjustments before the project gets to Kaka'ako, where she is a recognized cultural descendant. What's your response to that argument?
Several responses. First of all, the record is clear that the route itself cannot be shifted. Secondly, the fundamental decisions have been made. The technological choice has been made, and the no-build option has been foreclosed. So these alternatives are no longer considered. You know, the archaeological inventory survey includes a requirement for good faith consultation with descendants. How is that consultation in good faith if fundamental decisions have already been made? Now, we have an expert opinion in the record from Dr. Abad in which she talks about how fundamental decisions that are now foreclosed because construction has commenced, making it more difficult to protect burials. And we have seen this in instance after instance after instance at ward villages where, and we have, Dr. Abad refers to it, we also have the minutes from the Oahu Island Burial Council, in which because General Growth had already spent so much money, certain redesign options were no longer practical. They were not available. And that is what is happening here. We're going to get to the point where the city spent $3 billion bringing a rail project to the edge of downtown, and the Oahu Island Burial Council is put in the position of deciding, do we protect these burials and leave them in place, or do we move them to facilitate a project for which we've already spent $3 billion? That kind of decision needs to be made up front before the money is spent. And we see that the importance that this court has given to that in Citizens for the Protection of the North Kohala Coastline, where this court talks about the inflexibility given in decision making when so much time and money has been spent, when there is, quite frankly, a post hoc rationalization for decisions that have already been made.
Is the policy that you talk about, a lot of the cases you've talked about are environmental impact statement cases, is that same policy of information being available before decision making at the front end of the process as strong or as clear in Chapter 6E, the historic preservation chapter?
Yes, it is. Before talking exactly about 6E, let me mention three other cases in which this theme emerges. Kapa'akai, which was a case regarding the Land Use Commission and its deferral of obtaining information about how traditional customary practices would be protected outside the context of 343. Hui Alaloa, a 205A case in which this court said that, no, you have to do your archaeological investigation first before an SMA permit is granted. And Kelly v. 1250 Oceanside, in which this court required a thorough assessment of water quality impacts early on. Turning to 6E itself, I think you find that requirement you find it in three things. In the plain language of the rules, you find it in the structure of the rules, and you can find it in the legislative intent. The plain language requires the inventory of all historic properties potentially and indirectly affected. Refusing to inventory some of them is completely contrary to that rule. To give you a simple, simplistic analogy, if I tell my son, eat all your broccoli, and he eats only a few pieces of broccoli, he hasn't complied with the rule. Here, layered on top of that is a sequential process that's laid out in 13284 and 13275. It's a step-by-step-by-step process. SHPD has a flowchart that lays it all out. If you read the rules all together, you see it's a natural progression of steps. These steps culminate, well, these steps lead to the conclusion of the historic review process. Only when the historic review process concludes can decision-making be made and can construction commence. The rules are explicit about that.
So is it your position that the rules prohibit the city and the state from phasing this project? Is that what you're arguing?
Correct. Correct. The
is
rules,
there any rule that says they cannot phase?
I would point to that exact specific language is not used. The National Historic Preservation Act explicitly allows phasing. Our rules are silent. State Historic Preservation Division could have incorporated a phrase like that in its rules if it had so chosen. It decided not to. Although, if it had done so, it would have been contrary to the legislative intent of Chapter 6E. But the plain language says you have to inventory all historic properties.
So, Mr. Franklin, if you don't mind, the difference between your position and the city's position is you're saying that the law requires there to be a sequential process as opposed to phasing. But the point that you're making with respect to the sequential process is that what was failed to be done or what was not done was an AIS for the whole project, according to your position, wasn't done. However, the city is not saying that they're not going to do an AIS. They're just suggesting that they can break the AIS up into four segments. And from a practical standpoint, looking at the law, if the law doesn't preclude phasing, why can't we conclude that because there's an absence of precluding phasing, that in fact it provides for phasing?
The rules say the historic review process concludes under five and only five circumstances. Those are laid very clearly out in the rules. First, if SHPD concludes there are no significant historic properties likely to be present. That's not the case here. Second, if an AIS finds no historic properties. That's not the case here. If SHPD determines that none of the historic properties in the area are significant. That's not the case here. They've admitted that the barrows likely to be present and barrows are significant, a significant historic property. Fourth, if SHPD concludes the project will have no effect on historic properties, that hasn't happened here. And fifth, if a mitigation plan has been successfully executed, that has not occurred here. What SHPD has attempted to do is create only when one of these five things occur can decision-making take place, can construction take place. That's what the rules lay out. It's laid out in SHPD's flowchart. It's laid out if you read the rules comprehensively all together. That's what's there. And because the rules do not allow the AIS process to be skipped, and because the process must be completed before decision making and construction, phasing of the AIS is not allowed. In addition, not only if you read the plain language and the structure of the rules, if you look at the legislative intent, look at section 6E-1, where the legislative intent is clearly laid out. Delaying information gathering is inconsistent with the notion of providing leadership in preserving, restoring, and maintaining historic cultural property, historic and cultural property. Delaying information gathering is inconsistent with preservation and enhancement of historic and cultural property.
But Mr. Frankel, the state argues that the programmatic agreement that was adopted in this case constitutes an interim protection plan under the regulations. That they, it's my understanding, they believe that there is a part of the regulations that authorizes them to enter into a programmatic agreement that allows for a phased approval. What's your response to that argument?
Twofold, Your Honor. An interim protection plan only can be developed after an archaeological inventory survey is done. The rules lay that out. If you look at, for example, 13-284-1, the goal of the review process is to identify significant historic properties and project areas, assess any effects, and then to develop and execute plans to avoid, minimize, or mitigate adverse effects to the significant historic properties. If you read the sequential nature of the rules, and we've highlighted in our brief, you go from one section to the next. It says, once this is done, then the other. Once you identify, then you study the significance. Once the significance is understood, then you consider the effects. Once you look at the effects, then you come up with a plan to mitigate. It's a sequential nature. And so what they've done is they've skipped the AIS process. Dr. Abad in her declaration discusses why it makes no sense from an archaeological perspective to develop an interim protection plan before you know what you're protecting. You have to identify the resources before you can protect them. What they have done is put the cart before the horse. They have said they will do later what they're already required to do before they make a decision and before they construct.
Now, there's no definition of interim protection plan in the rule, in Rule 275 or 284. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is used in a couple places. It's used in 13284-3 and also in 13284-9. And let me just clarify. When I refer to 284, the same language is found in 275.
Correct. So either one. But yes. Let me ask you about this. And there's a chapter entitled Rules Governing Requirements for Archaeological Site Preservation and Development, Chapter 277. It has a provision 13277-5 that talks about interim protection measures, which sounds very similar to interim protection plan. It talks about items such as flagging the perimeter of the buffer zone during construction activity, erecting barriers, placing avoidance instructions on construction plans, on-site pre-construction briefings of the construction firm, and having an archaeological monitor on site. So this reference in 277 to interim protection measure appears to relate to measures that are taken during the construction process. How does that fit into the arguments you're making about whether an interim protection plan can be the kind of programmatic agreement was entered into here?
Generally speaking, buffer zones, you can only create a buffer zone when you know what the historic site is that you're protecting. So you have to identify the historical site first before you establish a buffer zone. That's standard practice in archaeological and historic preservation work. There's really nothing inconsistent with what I'm saying and what's in this section of the rule. The other issue is found in 13284-3, where it talks about allowing when there is an interim protection plan in place that the construction can commence. But the language is very interesting. It says, in cases where any interim protection plans are adequately in place and any data recovery field work has been adequately completed, the project may commence from a historic preservation perspective. Well, the data recovery field work hasn't been completed. It hasn't really been started. So they have put the cart before the horse. They've done what the rules explicitly prohibit.
What about the definition of project? The argument, as I understand it from the city, is that they can define what a project is and define it, in this case, to be something that's broken up into four quarters, four segments. We should defer to that because they're the administrative agency charged with implementing these rules, and deference should be given to an agency in that role, in that situation.
We have several responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, we can't separate this case from the facts. In this case, we have a stipulation that the project is building the fixed rail system from West Oahu to Ala Moana through Kaka'ako. We have an admission in the record in which the city has admitted it is one indivisible project. So it cannot factually be separated. More directly, however, if we look at the definition of a project area in the rules, the definition requires that all the historic sites that may be potentially affected, directly or indirectly. Given that definition, how could one segment a project into components or phases? Because A later phase is clearly going to be at least indirectly affected, and the requirement of the AIS to inventory all historic properties that will be that are in the project area, that would be violated if you segment it. So that's what the rule requires. I want to turn back to the legislative intent. We talked about what's in 6E-1. There are other, the legislative intent is manifested in other ways as well. For example, 6E makes clear that historic properties should be treated in a spirit of stewardship and trusteeship. A trustee must act with a level of openness, diligence, and foresight. A trustee must take a global, long-term perspective and consider cumulative impacts. Identifying historic properties that may be affected by a project after approval of a project is inconsistent with the principle of administering historic and cultural property in a spirit of stewardship and trusteeship for future generations.
It's argued by the other side that, and you've already noted that the Hawaii law is silent on phase. It's argued that we should look to federal regulations, which do provide. Do you have any comment with respect to that? If it's silent, why shouldn't we look to what basically the federal regulations provide?
If we were talking about case law, it makes sense to look at federal case law. Here is a rule that the federal government enacted. The state could have copied that rule. In fact, it manifests an intent not to incorporate that by being silent. But, you know, I'd also direct you to a number of federal cases in which there was no rule, no specificity, no discussion about phasing. And the courts have uniformly prohibited it. In the context of 4F, which protects parks but also historic sites, back in 1973, I believe, the federal appellate court concluded that in named individual members of San Antonio Conservation Society, that it would frustrate the effect of, the piecemealing would frustrate the effect of the law. Or take the Washington appellate court, which found that both the Coastal Zone Management Act and their equivalent of 343, the vitality of those provisions would be undermined by allowing piecemealing, looking against the legislative intent. Or when it comes to the Endangered Species Act, or when it comes to NEPA, before the current regulations that are under NEPA, one of the first courts to look at this issue looked at the congressional policy and said that segmenting of the project is impermissible. It was an impermissible bureaucratic exercise that would frustrate the congressional policy. So it is that policy that needs to be looked at. What's the policy here? Well, in 1988 and again in 1990, the legislature specifically enacted legislation to protect burials. That was the purpose of enacting 6E-42. That was the purpose of enacting 306. And when burials are not identified prior to decision-making, they're vulnerable to the disinterment that the legislature was seeking to avoid. Finally, the Archaeological Inventory Survey requires consultation and good faith. How can it be in good faith if you've already approved the project? So that's the policy of the legislature that would be frustrated if piecemealing, phasing, or segmentation.
But their argument, the city's argument, is that 6E is much more site-specific rather than focused on the entire project. It's focused on protecting particular sites that are identified during the course of that process. Their argument is those sites could be protected because they could move the piers that support this rail system front or back or put them on the side in a way that makes it, I guess they would say, and I'd be interested in your thought of what the record establishes, that highly likely that they would be able to protect the burials that they encounter. What's your response to that? And you just hit your 23 minutes, but if you could go ahead and answer the question.
Sure. We have Dr. Abad's declaration in the record where she talks about the fact that it's not possible. She points to past practice where it hasn't been possible. And in this case, because it's not just piers, the entire infrastructure, we're talking sewage lines, water pipelines, electric lines, would all have to be moved. There's a massive amount, and simply relocating a pier here or there is unlikely to protect burials. Secondly, the fundamental decisions have already been made. So if you need to alter the technology or alter the route to protect the burials, that will not be possible because the decision's already been made. And I suppose related to that is the fact that it is too late to be asking her to participate in consideration of the treatment, appropriate treatment of burials, because those fundamental decisions have been made. Her ability to participate in an informed way, in a good faith way, is violated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. Mr. Minow, on behalf of the city.
Yes. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. I think it's very important to note up front that the city has been very sensitive to the issue of burials throughout this process over the last several years. They have consulted extensively with SHPD, State Historic Preservation Division, the Oahu Island Burial Council, and other cultural and lineal descendants about this very issue, what to do if we develop this rail project and we run into burials along the course. Now, in consultation with the various departments and the descendants, this plan was developed, the programmatic agreement plan for handling a phased approach to the uncovering of burials through the AIS. That has been fully vetted through all of these different groups, and all of their concerns, their questions, qualifications were fully considered. So the idea that this is somehow sprung by the city and sprung by the state at the last minute completely ignores that long process.
I think the purpose. What did the State Historic Preservation Division actually approve? Did they approve one project or did they approve four different projects?
They approved the programmatic agreement, which sets forth a project that is broken up into four phases, or what we call activities. We believe that they are allowed to interpret a project as either one entire project or separate activities within the project, so long as all of the protections afforded and required by 6E are recognized. We believe the programmatic agreement sets forth a very detailed plan to follow each and every one of the steps that Mr. Frankel referred to. The only question is the timing and the sequence. Every single one of those steps that Mr. Frankel refers to will be performed, will be completed here. They will be done in phases before any ground disturbing work occurs in a particular phase.
Is it your argument that the program agreement is an interim protection plan?
You raise an interesting question. We've struggled with this because there is the definition or the wording interim protection plan in 13.275.3, which says that if you have an interim protection plan in place, then in essence you can proceed. Mr. Frankel referred to 13.284.3, which seems to have a conjoined and condition. 13.275.3 does not. 13.275.3 says if you have an interim protection plan in place, you can proceed. You know, at the higher lawyer level, I would say that yes, those words exist there, and you could construe the programmatic agreement as an interim protection plan. How that's implemented by the people on the ground, the archaeologists, they may look at it, and when you look at 13.277. You know, that's much more in the minutia area as to how you actually perform measures to protect specific sites. So there may be a broad range of potential measures that would include flagging and creating buffer zones that in a smaller sense, in a site-specific sense, would be more restrictive.
So yes or no, sorry to push you, but yes or no, is it an interim protection plan? Is this programmatic agreement an interim protection plan within the meaning of the applicable Hawaii regulations?
I believe it can be articulated as one, yes.
Okay, and how do you respond to Mr. Frankel's argument that that's contrary to the plain language of the regulations, which appear to indicate a very evolved sequential process with very specific exceptions and just this one reference to interim protection plan, which, according to him, viewed in context, appears to be a type of mitigation measure that arises well downstream from the inventory process that we're talking about here today. Could you respond to those arguments, please?
If this is an interim protection plan and the words are read that way, then we believe we can proceed. If that is rejected, we do believe we can still proceed based on the approval by SHPTE in the programmatic agreement that allows a phased approach or a phasing of the four construction sections of this project as separate activities. The way we would read this is a project can be interpreted and defined by the agency as either an entire project, scope, geographic area, or they could also look at separate activities within that project, because the definition of project is any activity. So in essence, and it gets back to the initial question about whether there's anything that expressly allows phasing, there is nothing that expressly allows phasing in any of these regulations.
Mr. Monaud, I have a question. Let's pretend, a hypothetical question. Let's assume we have a 100-acre residential development by a private developer. And the private developer intends to construct the development in four phases of 25 acres each. Are you suggesting that that project can be divided into four phases in terms of AISs?
In terms of AIS, I believe SHPTE has discretion to review the initial plan proposed by the developer.
You're arguing that the regulations allow four separate phases for AISs, four separate AISs in those circumstances.
There are no express words in the regulations. I believe that SHPTE has the discretion to interpret the definition of project and interpret its own rules to allow them to approve such a project.
Actually, it is for this court to determine what the law requires, is it not?
Ultimately, yes, it is.
Let me ask you this. Often the city requires dedication for park purposes in a residential development. Let's say that the city required 25 acres to be dedicated to a park, and let's say that, and then the SHPTE allowed phasing. Let's say that after the development of the first 75 acres, first three phases, when there was finally an AIS for the fourth phase, it discovered significant iwi kupuna in the entire 25 acres. Do you think that this type of process is what the law envisions?
I believe it has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis by the agency. And I believe under that hypothetical, there could be a problem. I don't think that problem, that type of problem, under the unique type of project that's proposed here, really poses itself. So I think it is distinguishable. I mean, we are talking about...
What if the AIS for the fourth phase discovers significant historical burial sites along the entire fourth phase?
The programmatic agreement requires that the any EV located during the AIS process is either going to be preserved in place based on consultation by the RDC and SHPTE, or it can be relocated. The project cannot build on top of or construct a structure into a whole area where a burial has been located, and that's simply not allowed under the programmatic agreement. The city has essentially bought into a programmatic agreement and a proposal, because it can, that essentially says they cannot build over on top of a burial site.
But then if Phase 3 is constructed all the way to Middle Street, and then the route is already determined. Doesn't phasing preclude rerouting?
The flexibility that is built into this project based on the PA allows for, well, there are two issues here, whether the alignment itself actually changes or whether along the alignment you can move the columns. And what this plan shows and what they've essentially planned out from the preliminary engineering drawings is that along the alignment route, the piers or the straddle bent piers can be adjusted somewhere close to 75 or 100 feet. So let's say you find three or four burials located within 15, 20 feet of each other, right in the middle of an existing roadway subsurface. Originally, you were going to put a column there. Well, you can't do that now. So what they have to do is they have to adjust the column forward, back, or they have to put in a new straddle bit. So that would mean that they are agreeing they cannot put a column where that burial is. So they avoid it completely. But the second issue that you referred to about the alignment, there is nothing that precludes this project from, at some point, if you run into a mass graveyard where you could not possibly put a pier, you know, put columns within 100 feet of each other, which based on the prior archaeological reports, extensive reports that were done here, do not indicate is the situation. But if you were to run into that, then, of course, at that point, they would have to consider possibly putting it down Queen Street, which would require a supplemental, putting it down, you know, one of the other potential aligned streets. So that has not been foreclosed here. I know Mr. Frankel indicates that it was, but it hasn't been.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Mr. Frankel makes a very good argument. After all three phases have been completed and you spend billions and billions of dollars, is the city really going to say, okay, well, we're going to realign now because we have run into some archaeological discoveries? Is that, practically speaking, is that really going to happen?
Well, that is what they're contractually required to do.
To realign?
Well, they will have to, because they cannot build on top of a burial. So if there is a site that prevents them from putting a column there, or it's so pervasive that they cannot put the alignment there, they can't do it. They've agreed to that in the programmatic agreement.
Didn't you mention before that Evie may be relocated?
Evie may be relocated, yes. That's one of the options based on a review by OIBC after the AIS phase. OIBC has jurisdiction to determine whether to relocate a burial, and if they do, then you know that's everybody will be in agreement on how to do it, and hopefully everybody will be fine with that. Yes.
You know, I want to go back to one of your the previous questions that Judge Brownian asked about Shifty's approval. Didn't, although the AIS is planned to be done in phases or segmented, Shifty didn't approve in phases. Didn't they approve the whole project?
What the programmatic agreement requires are essentially two levels of approvals. One, they approved in the programmatic agreement the overall project, and they gave their concurrence that it could proceed in this manner in a phasing. But what is also required in the programmatic agreement, that after the AISs are done in each phase, they must then follow that and give final written concurrence to construction proceeding in that phase before any ground disturbing work can happen in that phase.
Don't the rules require that an AIS be done before SHPD approves the project?
Again, this comes back to the concept of phasing. And what we, our position is that we have gotten approval to do the entire project in a phased manner, and that each phase can be broken out into four separate concurrence requirements. They have reviewed, in essence, the flexibility afforded by the programmatic agreement. And again, from our point of view, there is a significant unique nature to this project that does allow for the movement of columns at the end to avoid any even.
There's nothing in the law or the rules specifically provide for phasing.
And under state law, that is true. And of course, we've got a federal overlay component here, which expressly allows for it. And if you get down to, you know, the policy issues here, there, in our view, should not be any real difference between how this is handled from the federal level as opposed to a state agency interpreting it in a similar manner for a long-term corridor project where you have access problems, you have to buy the property.
But weren't the state drafters of the rules aware of the federal rules provided?
There's no indication in the legislative history that this was ever considered. It simply is not on the radar screen.
Aren't there actual references to the federal regulations and the state regulations?
Yeah, there are references to the federal regulations.
And aren't some of the provisions modeled on the federal regulations?
Yes, but this specific issue about phasing and whether to include it or not exists nowhere in the history.
But the federal regulations did allow phasing at that time. And when Hawaii adopted its regulations in, is it 2003, October 11th? I can't tell from the writing. Is it 2003? When Hawaii adopted its regulations, it did not include the federal regulation that allowed phasing. Is that correct?
We don't know whether that was intentional.
And the programmatic agreement was actually something that was required by the federal government's law, National Historic Preservation Act, correct?
It was one of the requirements, yes.
And under the federal regulations, such phasing is allowed.
That's correct.
Just coming back to one issue that you raised about whether this route is locked in or not, is it not a requirement of getting approval from the federal government to change the route? That is a requirement, is it not? Or is that even established in the record?
Yes, there's no doubt that if the route or the alignment moves in any significant manner, they're going to have to get approvals from everyone across the board.
Okay. And is there anything in the record to establish whether the federal government is even open to realigning the route at this point?
Well, the types of realignment that we're talking about would be moving in phase four from what is essentially the Halikawila Street issue to possibly Queen Street or, let's say, Ala Moana. I mean, those areas were all studied generally in the archaeological technical report. Halikawila was picked as the least, offensive initially, you know, based on the history.
My question is, you know, your argument is that if a large burial site were located along Halikawila, there could be a move to another corridor or another route. But is there anything in the record to indicate that the federal government would even be open to a changing of the route once the project has been built all the way close to downtown, even before at least through phase one into phase two?
There is nothing to indicate that they would say no to that. There's nothing that would indicate they would say yes. It's an issue that would have to be, you have to go through the supplemental EIS process, I believe, in order to change that significant.
And this motion was decided with very early in this case. If I understand correctly, there were discovery requests outstanding, but in fact the responses weren't due until after the first day of the hearing in this matter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is it your position, though, that none of the discovery that might have been done could have been helpful in answering some of the questions like the one I just raised as to what's the position of the federal government?
Well, I mean, helpful or not? The federal government doesn't have an answer to that possibility, but again, I think what we're talking about here comes down to discrete issues of law, and that's what Judge Chang focused on. We're dealing with the interpretation of 6E as to whether the agency is allowed to approve this type of project as a phased activity project. Under 343, we know the Price v. Obayashi standard, which is it's a summary judgment issue. I mean, you have to resolve it on summary judgment. So really, at the first level, we're talking about legal issues here. And I would like to point out one sort of a difficult wrinkle, but relates to the standing question Justice Nakayama asked. We did not specifically challenge standing at the lower level. I guess what we were trying to articulate, and I think this was understood is that, in essence, Chapter 6E creates a limitation and the right of action for a party to come to court and challenge an action. There's no separate private cause of action outside of 6E. And so our view is 6E contains the legal basis for a potentially aggrieved claimant to come to court and challenge the actions of the agency. And that is under the 6E13B standard.
What's your response to her argument that there is an injury in her not having been consulted prior to the decision being made to go with this technology and this route?
Right. If you focus on 6E13B, there is a requirement that she must show irreparable injury. And truthfully, there is no threat to any burial anywhere along this route, the 20 miles, until after we do the AIS process that the appellant wants us to do. So the request here is to do an AIS, and we are going to do an AIS. In fact, the AIS that we're doing in phase four is much more extensive than anything that would have happened if it had been done before all of this consultation effort. And the standard AIS would not have included 100% trench sampling.
But isn't that the point, Council? I mean, you just stated that there's no actual threat to any burials. But the point is we don't know, because an AIS wasn't done for the full 20 miles. And if an AIS was done, then the people that are affected or may be affected by this particular project would know.
For 6E purposes, if there is a requirement to do an AIS, and SHPD has discretion to say we don't need an AIS for certain projects, but here we have an AIS requirement. We are going to do the AIS. So that
we're talking about standing.
Yes.
And you were talking about whether or not there was an irreparable injury here.
Right.
Your argument was we don't know because then nothing has been identified. Is that correct?
Well, my position is under 6E13B, the appellant must show, they're required to show an irreparable injury.
Was this raised below? You said it wasn't raised below. Is that right? Did you argue this at the trial court?
We did argue this. Okay. What I was saying is it was sort of, there's no constitutional challenge to 6E here.
Okay.
And what we're saying is, in essence, there's also no separate private cause of action. So it's not a standing issue, but there's no separate private cause of action. 6E13 should control any effort to challenge that the determination of SHPD.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minow. Now we'll hear from Mr. Weinoff on behalf of the state defendants other than the OIBC.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Yes, please, the court. I'd like to start off by quoting something from Judge Gary Chang's decision in this case. It strains the court's notion of reasonableness to interpret the word project as requiring a halt to earth-disturbing construction activities in Kapolei until an archaeological study can be completed in Kaka'ako. The court is unable to comprehend how disturbing the earth in Kapolei can adversely affect Iwi Kupuna in Kaka'ako, with the possible exception of the plaintiff's concerns regarding administrative or bureaucratic inertia.
When did SHPD come into existence?
I beg your pardon?
When did your client come into existence?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Preservation Division.
I heard you asking the question about when the rules were, and so I started to look at the rules, and both 284 and 275 indicate that they were adopted as of December 2003. SHPD was in existence considerably before that. I believe it was in the 90s. I think Mr. Frankel probably has that more at his fingertips, but I do not know the answer.
It would have been possible for the rules to be drafted to include phasing as the federal regulations allow.
Certainly. No question about that.
Mr. Weinoff, speaking of Judge Chang's very eloquent and clearly well thought out findings of facts and conclusions of law, the part that you quote, though, talks about how it's implausible or impractical to talk to address what may happen based on distance between the different phases.
Yes.
But if we start interpreting the law based on the distance, isn't that a dangerous path? How do we know what is far enough away so that we don't need to address the impracticalities?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and I think it's similar, in my mind, it's similar to the question that Justice McKenna asked, too, about her hypothetical about a 100-acre parcel. I think the answer to the question is that phasing a project is clearly going to be allowable in some cases and not allowable in other cases. There are particular rules and case law with respect to linear projects in particular, and so I would suggest that because we have a linear project here where we are, in fact, 10 or 15 miles away from the possibly affected EVE, that it is, in this case, it is in fact a reasonable determination by the agency charged with making that determination to determine that this particular project could be done in phases. With respect to the 100-acre parcel that Justice McKenna determined, maybe the agency wouldn't make that determination, and maybe certainly this court is not a rubber stamp. I'm not suggesting that at all, but this court is, in fact, sort of secondarily reviewing the agency charged with the situation. And so the question really is it a reasonable determination? Is it arbitrary and capricious deference, great deference under Lee versus Elbaum?
Right. And to answer that question, you looked at the rules, correct? Because I read your brief. And in your brief, you looked at the rules, and perhaps I'm sure you read the provisions that Mr. Frankel has talked about that are very specific about requiring a very detailed sequential process of survey followed by identification, impact, significance, mitigation. And the argument you advanced was that this particular approach taken here of the programmatic agreement was okay because it was an interim protection plan under the rules. That's your argument, correct?
I think, yes.
It was.
That's one of my arguments. I think it is an interim protection plan, and I also think that more specifically, so the answer to that is yes. I would also like to say it's not my only argument, because the other argument I have is that each and every one of those steps has in fact been taken, but with respect to each of the phased projects.
But where in the rules does it say that SHPTE can in essence adopt this phased process rather than following the process that appears to be set forth in its own rules, which is a very linear process that has only a very few exceptions, one of which might be this interim protection plan, which you advanced in your brief. The city has some doubt about it, I guess, or had some concerns about that theory. How do we get around the plain language of the rules? That's my question to you.
The answer to the question, Your Honor, is what is the What is the project? It's our position that, with respect to that particular question, that the project, as that word is used in the rules, the project refers to each of the different phases. And I'd also like, in addressing that, I'd also like to comment on some of the questions about timing. The city has disclosed, it's in the record, that in its answering brief, I think it was footnote 3, because I was looking at it while those questions were being asked, and this goes to the question of the possibility of whether there will be irreparable harm. The timing of this is such that, as everybody who reads the paper knows, phase one has already started out in Kapolei. But as the city mentions in its brief, the AIS with respect to phase four has already been started. As of December of 2011, they disclosed, as they said here, that they're going to be trenching to actually find. They've already done considerable work to see whether there's the extent of the EV Kapuna in the particular corridor that they're doing. They did not find any in the preliminary study. They've already started the EIS for Project 4. They're going to be digging 272 trenches. 10% of those were dug as of December of 2011, and no EV Kapuna have been found. So that EIS is going to be completed well before. It's not like you're going to get to the middle street and then they're going to start the AIS. So that is going to give them considerable additional flexibility. There's billions of dollars at stake. There was a $500 million at stake in Super Ferry, and this court didn't hesitate to stop that project. Judge Chang made very clear to the city and to the state that he, if charged with that, would not hesitate to stop the project. But the answer to the question of simply throwing billions of dollars away if the project had to be stopped is that it's not they're going to get to Middle Street and all of a sudden think, well, now we better start looking for the bones. That's going to have been done long, long before even phase one is done.
But you've committed, the city is committed to a particular technology. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And to a particular route at this point?
No, it's not committed to a particular route.
It is not committed to a particular.
It's not committed to a particular route, as I understand it, and I've heard, I believe I heard Mr. Minot say that it was not committed to a particular route, that it would go down Queen Street or other routes if it had to. So there's flexibility at two levels. First, it is not committed to the route if it needs to change the route. It will find out. We will know in the relatively near future whether there's some problem with the preferred route that is simply insurmountable. That seems very unlikely given what we already know from the preliminary archaeological study, which did not disclose any EV in the particular route. Given what we know from as of December, we've already trenched 10% of the trenches and have not found any EV as of that point. So it seems unlikely that there's going to, and given the fact, as Mr. Minot also said and is in his brief, that as you know, that given the technology, it's elevated on columns and it's going to be in contact with the earth in a relatively limited amount of areas. Those columns can be relocated within tens or dozens of feet, as he said. So that gives us some flexibility within the route, and it's also what I heard today and what has been represented throughout this project to SHPD is that the route itself could be changed. Now, that's going to not be that easy, but it is not foreclosed if it becomes necessary to do that.
Mr. Wynn, I know your time is up, but I want to ask you a question. To clarify, I didn't quite understand what you're saying. The AIS for the Kaka'ako portion has already commenced?
Has already commenced, yes, Your Honor. That's in footnote 3 of the opening brief. It has commenced. As of December, they had trenched, I believe the footnote says 10% of the 272 trenches that they intend to do to make sure every inch of it, and none of those trenches have discovered any EV to date.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wynow. Mr. Franco will have your rebuttal. Thank you.
Let me respond to a blizzard of points. First of all, this is one project. We have an admission in the record, the admission we sent. All four phases of the Honolulu High Capacity Transit Corridor project are connected and part of a single project. The city admits. So we're only talking about one project.
Was that directed also to the state?
No, it was not. However, there's a stipulation that all the parties entered into, which is also in the record, that says the project includes construction of a fixed guideway system from West Oahu to Olamoana Center. So, I think it is terribly revealing that this court asked the city, if this is an interim protection plan, how could it be approved? What in the rules allows it to be approved? There's never any answer given, because an interim protection plan can only happen after the inventory survey is done. Although the city and state have claimed now that the route can be altered, that's argument. If we look at the record itself, there's no evidence in the record that says the route can be moved or would be moved. I want to reiterate what's in the briefs about why you should not defer to the State Historic Preservation Division. We've given you four reasons. First, there's a heightened degree of scrutiny here because the resources at issue need to be treated as trust resources. 6E13B, 6E-1, and Act 306 all refer to historic properties and burials as being treated as trust resources, which requires a higher degree of scrutiny by this court, a hard look, as it were. Secondly, the SHPD's interpretation is inconsistent with the legislative purpose of 6E and its implementing rules. It's also plainly erroneous and an unreasonable interpretation, given that phasing is not authorized in the rule. And finally, the interpretation is directly at odds with the Oahu Island Burial Council, which shares a statutory role to play in inventorying burial sites. Let me address the harm a little bit more. I talked about the three strands or themes that are found in your cases. The failure to consider impacts before decision making is harmful, failure to consider impacts holistically or comprehensively, and failure to facilitate public participation in the decision making process is also harmful. I cited a bunch of cases for that first proposition. The second one, the failure to consider impacts holistically or comprehensively. If you go back to Molokai Homesteaders, the first 343 case this court looked at, the court didn't look at any specific rules. It just said, you know, if you have a water pipeline that's transmitting water from one end of Molokai to the other, then you have to look at the secondary impact, which includes building a resort. The court recognized the importance of looking at things holistically or comprehensively. This theme was reiterated in Superfarian, Citizens, Kahana Sunset, Sierra Club versus Office of Planning, and in Kelly versus 1250 Oceanside, asking for a thorough assessment. Finally, the idea that the failure to facilitate public participation is harmful. Kahana Sunset, you had a case where the county and the developer failed to prepare an environmental assessment. There was a contested case hearing, and this court held that, you know, you have to give that information to citizens so that they can participate without having a burden, so they can really fully articulate their process, fully participate in the decision-making process. Similarly, in Waihole, this court noted the importance of decision-making with a level of openness. No such openness is had if information gathering is delayed. I briefly want to mention Chapter 343. Chapter 343, the rules say the EIS process shall involve, at a minimum, conducting necessary studies. We have the city and state agreeing the EIS is a necessary study. And information in 343 is supposed to come before decision making. If we all agree an EIS should be conducted, the only question is when it should be done, before or after decision making. Case law is replete saying it has to be before decision making. Chapter 205A requires the city to give full consideration to cultural and historic values. The city has given these values short shrift. They have made substantive decisions regarding technology, route, and more fundamentally, the no build or build option, without knowing what archaeological resources will be affected. Where are they? How many are there? And is it even technologically feasible now to go on this route?
Mr. Frank, okay. What about discovery in this matter? Would you agree purely a question of law, don't need discovery, or is there an interest or a value to having a better factual record regarding, for example, whether there really is an option to move this project to a different route?
Your Honor, I would say fundamentally, I agree with the city, this is a question of law. If this court looks at the entire record, including all the exhibits that we attached to our motion for reconsideration, I think that is a fairly sufficient record. We do not think we were given sufficient time at the time that the court ruled on the motion to dismiss or on the alternative summary judgment. But by the time the motion for recon was filed, we included the exhibits.
Thank you.
Mr. Frankel, if the regulations explicitly did allow phasing, do you think you would still be here?
I think we would have a more difficult time. However, we would think if it allowed phasing, we think that's inconsistent with the legislative intent in Chapter 6E and the constitutional protection that needs to be provided to traditional customary practices, including the protection of EV.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frankel. The court will take this matter under advisement. And thank you to all our counsel today for your argument.